Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 15th of February 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. The weekend is finished, and it's the start of another week. And who better to join me here today to discuss the news of interest to British nationalists than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. It's a bit cold and miserable here. What's it like where you are?
Well, we've had several cold days on the trot, but I think, as I said last week, I don't mind the cold weather, actually. I really like driving in the snow, and I've been a bit disappointed that I haven't been able to find pretext to leave the house so that I can sort of legitimately drive in the snow during the course of this week. I've only sort of driven through a very small amount of snow, to be quite honest, but I can remember past years when we had really deep snow and when there were lots of warnings that we should not go out unless it was in the case of an emergency because the snow was so bad. And I used to go out and love driving in those conditions because cars tend to slide a little bit. And, you know, as long as you're in a place where there is no likelihood of you colliding with anybody else, if you're going along a country lane, then you can practice doing sort of a little bit of controlled opposite lock drifting of your car as you go around corners and things, and it's just excellent fun. But we haven't been able to enjoy that, but the weather has been cold, and I've quite enjoyed it. You know, I like walking in cold, crisp air. It's very invigorating.
Very bracing, isn't it? I noticed it looked like the Thames had frozen over, and we're being told all about this global warming, yet we've had a real cold snap over the last week. It does look like it's going to heat up a little bit this week. And it looks like things have been getting a little bit more interesting on the political side of things over the last week. I hear that the Labour Party are going to be rivaling Patriotic Alternative soon for the biggest Patriotic Nationalist Party in Britain. Are my ears deceiving me, Max? What's going on here?
Well, I think there's been a bit of a realisation on the part of certain people in the Labour Party that the loss of the Red Wall constituencies during the last general election was very much down to the fact that the Labour Party has been perceived as being unpatriotic and anti-British, which I think is a pretty accurate description of the Labour Party, to be quite honest. But there are people within the Labour Party who I suppose are kind of progressive from a right-wing perspective and who are attempting to turn the tide as far as that sort of thing is concerned. I noticed a book for sale a few months ago called Despised by a chap called Paul Embury, who is a lifelong Labour supporter, and he's identified clearly that if the Labour Party want to form a government again, then they need to win back the patriotic left, basically, that the Labour Party have pretty much deserted over recent decades. And it was interesting, I noticed fairly recently that the leader of the Labour Party has been posing as a patriot now. And so we've had Keir Starmer, there's been photographs of him in newspapers, and I believe he did a Labour Party broadcast, I'm not quite sure, but he made some kind of a speech on television where he was positioned with a union flag in the background, as if, you know, having a union flag draped against the wall was something which is sort of typically found in a Labour Party office. There's a fair bit been spoken about in the news about the fact, you know, his desire to reposition the Labour Party as more patriotic. But I was quite amused by the fact that a Labour Party policy committee has been published within the last week by a chap called Sean Patrick Griffin, who's the party's external governance officer. And in this, it's called Remaking of the British State for the Many, Not the Few. And it argues that the UK should make reparation payments and an unreserved apology to all of the countries of the world that the British Empire invaded and negatively impacted. The 234-page document was published last week, as I said, by Sean Patrick Griffin, The report carries a foreword signed by leader of the opposition's office, London. So presumably this is actually Keir Starmer's office that's provided a foreword. Whether Keir Starmer actually wrote the thing himself or whether somebody else wrote it for him, that would appear to be the case. Perhaps we'll find out for sure later on. And it calls for also for the abolition of trade union laws, which would lead to a return of flying pickets and general strikes. It calls for the disestablishment of the Church of England. It calls for the House of Lords to be abolished and replaced by a Senate of nations and regions. It calls for restrictions on Britain's ability to declare war by requiring military activity to pass a vote in both Houses of Parliament. And it calls for the abolition of all of the trappings and the add-ons of the monarchy. And so it's sort of interesting that no sooner have the Labour Party supposedly sorted out all their problems by getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn than we're in a situation where the Labour Party has descended into kind of civil war again with the Keir Starmer attempting to position the party as more patriotic, whereas the rump, I suppose, of what perhaps could be called the Corbynite members of the party all doing their very best to deny him any sort of real kudos from that perspective. And so it's just been really, really amusing to see that happen. So we'll all have to watch with great interest to see how the Labour Party struggles on in this respect.
How they show they're patriotic. I mean, that's just ludicrous, isn't it? Posing in front of a flag. Priti Patel did that as well this week. She was posing in front of a flag and people were pointing it out that it still had creases in it. It had obviously been folded up somewhere and just pulled out for the interview. I mean, you don't get much more patriotic than calling for reparations to other countries and the end of the monarchy and all that stuff there that you were talking about, Max. I mean, it's just the complete opposite of what patriotism is really about. I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to identify what it is about Keir Starmer that is different because he's such a bland character. They're trying to come up with something called Starmerism, and they're not quite sure what that's going to be yet, whether it means posing in front of a flag or calling for slavery reparations. And it's really quite insulting to start calling for reparations for the British Empire invading other countries. The British Empire went to other countries, it traded with them, and it didn't just trade with them. It built civilization in those countries. It built railways, it built schools, it built communications infrastructure, it built roads, it taught them how to read. In some places, it taught them how to wear clothes. We brought civilization to these people. We brought medicine to these people. They would not even be in a position where they could add up money. They could actually do maths and add up figures to say we want reparations if we hadn't taught them these things. We should be charging them for this. If anything, they should be paying us reparations, not saying that we should pay them for actually helping them out. The British Empire is responsible for, you know, education in these countries. It's incredible the number of things you can think of that were brought to backwards countries that some of them weren't even wearing clothes, some of them didn't have a written language, some of them never had a history. Okay, you could say India had a history, but India was in a very bad way when we went there, and they were all being oppressed by these Muslim warlords. And we took out the Muslim warlords, and we took out the Hindus that were engaged in human sacrifice. We prevented that. The same in Africa. We did away with slavery. We did away with human sacrifice. And the natives in these countries were very pleased to actually have law and order for the first time in centuries. For the first time, in fact, since the last time white people had been there, whether that was in Roman times in Africa or whether that was with the Aryan invasions in India. I mean, the inter-tribal warfare was absolutely ferocious. It was the same thing in America. You had inter-tribal warfare between the Indians. And that's why a lot of the Indians joined the white man when he went to war against some of these other red Indians. And it was the same thing in India. It was the same thing in Africa. Personally, I think we should have just left these countries alone. We should have taken our resources that we wanted to take, mining or what have you, and we should have just said no, we mustn't interfere with these peoples. But unfortunately we did interfere with them, And by interfering, I mean the actual motive there was a charitable motive. It was, look at these people, they don't live in a very good way, they have a lot of warfare, they don't have sanitation. Look at all the wonders that we have. We should share the wonders of our civilization with these people and raise them up from the situation that they are in. And hopefully, after we have raised them up from this situation, they will be able to govern themselves. And that was always the mentality of the British Empire. And what happened at the end of the war, they were given the countries and told that they could govern themselves. And we didn't say to them, oh, and by the way, you now owe us for the infrastructure, for the roads, for the railways, for the hospitals, for the schools, for the university, for all the tuition that we gave your people. We didn't say that at all. We gave them those countries and we said, now you can run them yourselves. And look at what's happened. Masses and masses of corruption, particularly in Africa, but also in India, where they're not really capable of doing this because they didn't develop these systems for themselves. We spent millennia developing our system of democracy and our system of governance, and they never did that. So when you hand that something like that to them, even though they may have had 200 years of training, they're still not able to actually make it function. And they're all in debt, and they all get aid from Britain. A certain percentage of our budget goes in aid. I mean, it's ludicrous that they're asking for reparations, but of course it is something you would expect to see from the Labour Party, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you've hit the nail on the head there with regard to the establishment of law and order, because what a lot of people forget is that the on other continents before British explorers went there, British colonisers went there, the various tribes that existed there were conducting wars, imperialistic wars against each other, where they were attempting to steal the land that the other tribes owned, and where they were engaging in genocide of the other tribes. Once they conquered another tribe, then they would genocide them so that they could keep their land, etc. And the only difference really between the rival tribes in those parts of the world and the British colonizers was the fact that we had greater technical expertise, we had more effective weapons, and we were better at waging war than they were. And so when we waged war against them, we were much more successful than they were waging war against each other. And that's why we were able to conquer whole continents. And I wouldn't agree with you entirely that our motives were entirely innocent in terms of doing this, and that we were entirely charitable in taking civilization, etc., to the Third World. I think as far as the expansion of the British Empire was concerned, we were extending British rule, and we believe that British rule was good, not just for us, but good for the peoples of the parts of the world that we conquered and that we merged into the British Empire. And I think that was undoubtedly the case, because those countries became richer, people in those countries better benefited in all the ways that you've described. But at the end of the day, after the Second World War, we decided that we didn't want to continue to hold on to the empire. And so as the countries of the empire showed their determination to be independent and their wish to be independent, we, with very little resistance, we granted them their wishes. And as you say, they became independent countries. And in the majority of cases, they haven't fared too well. It is iniquitous of them to blame us for the fact that they have that they still are not as economically advanced as they would like to be, because we've given them a massive leap forward. In some cases, when we went to various parts of the world, the people living there were still effectively living in the Stone Age, and we lifted them out of the Stone Age and brought them into the modern world. And we may not have given them everything that we had, that we provided for ourselves, but we at least gave them that massive step forward. And so there should be some gratitude, I think, on their part for the work that we did in helping them modernize.
Yeah, we gave them the opportunity to better themselves. We taught them these skills and said, well, here are your resources. We'll set up means to extract those resources. We'll teach you how to extract those resources. And then you should be able to do this for yourself. It's not about us handing everything over to them. And then we get them calling for reparations and pulling down statues, and even for pulling down statues of Cecil Rhodes, whose scholarship actually funded them. And this is another trend that the Labour Party are involved in, and particularly Sadiq Khan, who set up a commission to look at road names and statues and anything he can find a tenuous link to slavery or the empire, and he wants to pull this down. And you were telling me, Max, that we've got a similar thing that's going on in Cambridge at the moment. There's a college there called Churchill College, and they're talking about changing this. I mean, Churchill is although we have criticised him a lot at Radio Albion, Churchill is still probably the most well-liked British character in history, and yet they are slandering Churchill now. Well, perhaps not slandering him, but smearing him. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's been going on at Cambridge, Churchill College at Cambridge, Max?
Well, there's a group of academics who feel that because of Churchill's racist opinions that he expressed on various occasions, and in spite of the fact that he was instrumental in winning the Second World War against the Germans, his reputation should be reduced, and he should be sort of held to, well, the Britain, that we should hold him to account for the views that he had, and that we shouldn't honour him in the way that we do by naming buildings after him and by naming this Churchill College after him. And the campaign basically is for his name to be removed from the college. And I think that it's interesting from our perspective that as far as Winston Churchill is concerned, he did actually make a number of statements which I think can quite obviously be regarded as racist, but he was a man of his time, and the vast majority of people in Britain during the early part of the 20th century and through to probably around about the 1970s did hold views very similar to the views that Churchill expressed. So it should come as no surprise that Churchill held these views. If I just read you some of the things that I've sort of picked out of the newspapers today, he once said, I don't know quite why he did, he must have been frustrated at the time, but he once said that he hated people with slit eyes and pigtails. To him, they were, to him, the people of India were the beastliest people in the world. He said that he didn't really think that black people were capable or were as capable or as efficient as white people. He stated that he thought that the white man was superior and was conquering the primitive dark-skinned natives. He said that as an MP, he demanded a rolling program of more conquests based on his belief that the Aryan stock is bound to triumph, apparently. His doctor, Lord Moran, apparently once said that Winston thinks only of the colour of their skin. In 1937, he told the Palestine Royal Commission, I do not admit for instance that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place. In one infamous memo, he stated, I am strongly in favour of using poison gas against uncivilised tribes. He admitted that he did not really think that black people were as capable or as efficient as white people. I mentioned that one earlier. In 1943, US Vice President Henry Wallace challenged Churchill's notion of Anglo-Saxon superiority. Churchill says here in this news transcript, who drank quite a bit of whiskey, as Wallace wrote, gave a blunt reply. According to Wallace's diary, he said, why be apologetic about Anglo-Saxon superiority, that we were superior, that we had a common heritage, which had been worked out over centuries in England and had been perfected by our constitution. And Churchill apparently even appeared to blame the Indians for the famine that occurred in 1943, claiming that they bred like rabbits. And apparently he referred to Mahatma Gandhi, stating, "It is alarming and nauseating to see Mr. Gandhi, a seditious Middle Temple lawyer, now posing as a fakir, striding half naked up the steps of the Vice Regal Palace." Churchill said of his anti-colonialist adversary in 1931, Gandhi should not be released on account of a mere threat of fasting. Churchill told the cabinet on another occasion, "We should be rid of a bad man and an enemy of the empire if he died." And from Churchill's book, The River War, he wrote, "How dreadful are the curses which Mohammedanism lays on its votaries, besides the fanatical frenzy which is as dangerous in a man as hydrophobia, that's rabies, is in a dog. There is this fearful fatalistic apathy. Improvident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, and insecurity of property exist wherever the followers of the prophet live." So he made quite a number of statements there which, you know, are undeniably racist, if indeed he did make them all. And I don't really doubt that he probably did, because he was known to be a person who said things very often for effect, in order to achieve the aims and ambitions that he had. I mean, he once wrote in an article for the Illustrated Sunday Herald, and this is in February 1920, which is entitled, the article was entitled "Zionism versus Bolshevism." He wrote, "This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky, Bella Kuhn, Rosa Luxemburg and Emma Goldman, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence and impossible equality, has been steadily growing. It has been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century, and now at last this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by their hair on their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire." And so clearly not only did Churchill hold racist views, but he held views, as some of the people who are criticising him, which are little different from the kind of views that Hitler held and that Hitler expressed in Mein Kampf and in his other writings and his speeches. And this is a point that I would like to make, that a lot of people condemn and criticise the patriotic right in this country. They accuse us of being Nazis, and they state, you know, "My father fought in the Second World War against people like you," and those sort of statements are made. But in reality, our fathers didn't fight in the Second World War against people like me. They fought in the Second World War following a man who had views that were very little different from the views of Adolf Hitler. They fought for Winston Churchill because Winston Churchill was British, and because they wanted to defend the British power, and they wanted to defend the British Empire as a world power at the time, and they wanted to defend Britain against the rising threat that was being posed to Britain by Nazi Germany. They weren't fighting against those views. They were fighting for Britain's position, entirely in accordance with the kind of views that I've just been reading out that were held by Winston Churchill. And so when people refer back to the Second World War as if the Second World War was a crusade against nationalism or a crusade against Nazism, that wasn't the case at all. It was a crusade by the people of the Allied countries in order to preserve and in order to further their own patriotism and their own nationalism. It wasn't against nationalism at all. And so the fact that in the modern era, people such as myself and yourself hold views that are patriotic and that are nationalistic is not out of place at all. It's actually in keeping with what has been the traditional patriotism that's existed in this country since time immemorial.
It's the views of our ancestors. I mean, we're told today that we were fighting to uphold democracy. No, we weren't. We were fighting against the Germans. We weren't fighting against National Socialism. We were fighting against the Germans because we had been told that the Germans wanted to invade Britain, and the Germans wanted to take over the world, and all this other nonsense that we know wasn't true. All Hitler wanted to do was expand into the East, because he saw that America had a huge country. He saw that Britain had all these colonies. He saw that France had all these colonies. Germany didn't have any colonies. And there was this land to the East that was relatively uncivilized, that would have really benefited from German ingenuity and German engineering. And that was what he wanted to do. And there was this big threat in the East as well from Bolshevism that was threatening the rest of Europe. And thanks to Hitler going into Russia, it arrested the advance of the Bolshevism into Western Europe. Unfortunately, at the end of the war, Bolshevism, well, it was just handed over to Bolshevism, wasn't it? The Baltic countries and the Balkans and a lot of the East and Poland and all these countries that we've been told that we were liberating, they were just handed over to Stalin. There was no battle of the ideologies here, and the British people just thought that they were defending their country. And they would have, if they had actually listened to translations of what Hitler was saying, they would have realized that he was just talking a lot of common sense and a lot of the ideas that the British people had anyway. Why should you apologize for being superior? And we were superior in strength and in battle and in technological prowess, and we defeated these lesser peoples that didn't have such good weapons, that didn't have gunpowder, that didn't have guns. And once we had defeated them, we gave them our civilization. It's not like we enslaved them once we had defeated them, or we genocided them, which is what these other peoples were used to doing. As you pointed out earlier, Max, you know, when they would have a battle, when they would have a war, they would either enslave the defeated, or they would wipe them all out. We never did that. Once we had defeated them, we would imprison the leader, or we would kill the leader, and we would say, now we're the leader, and we will enforce law and order, and we will have British law in this country, which means that you will be safe to go about your business. And the natives were very pleased with that once they had leaders, people that were ruling over them, that actually had a system of morals and didn't believe in might was right, but actually believed in justice. And that's what the British people believed in. I mean, as we've looked at some of these characters from the British Empire, they were the most upright, most moral people that you could think of, that put other people's needs before their own. I mean, Churchill was not a good example of that. He put his needs before anybody else. But as far as his views on race and Anglo-Saxon supremacy are concerned, they were the views of everybody at that time in America and also in Britain. I don't know if you want to add any more to that, Max, or should we get into Enoch Powell?
No, I think we've spoken enough about that. Yes, I think we can go on to Enoch Powell now. Yes.
Let's get into our Greatest Britain then, because this is talking about this very time. I do find it fascinating looking back at the British Empire and the end of the British Empire, and looking back at history from a nationalist viewpoint. You know, I've been learning so much from doing this series. I hope our listeners are learning a lot from this as well. We'll begin with a summary of what we've covered so far on our Greatest Britain, Enoch Powell. Powell worked for intelligence during the war and was suspicious of America's designs on the British Empire, seeing them as a greater threat than either Germany or Japan. He went to India, preparing for his life's aim of becoming Viceroy of India, where he was promoted to Brigadier, becoming the youngest Brigadier, like he had earlier been the youngest professor in the Commonwealth, and telling a colleague that he expected to be the head of all military intelligence in the next war. After returning to England, his ambition to be viceroy was crushed when he learned that the greatest prize of the empire had been lost. India was to be granted independence. So he entered into politics, strongly of the opinion that Britain should now give up pretending to be one of the world powers. That accolade now belonged to America and the newly formed USSR. And the USSR, as you pointed out last week, was the real winner out of the Second World War. That was the new world power that took the place that Britain had before the war. And he discovered that he had a talent for speaking when he gave a speech in Parliament lamenting the loss of the word British in the wording to the Statute of Westminster, and also the loss of Britain's claim to 9 separate territories in the Commonwealth. So it was really that really marked the end of the British Empire at that point when he gave this speech. Do you want to add anything to that, Max? Got any comments you'd like to make on that?
No, I think that's a very accurate thing. I mean, as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, I don't know that the Soviet Union necessarily replaced Britain from the previous power structure that existed internationally. What happened was that the Soviet Union occupied the space that the Germans wanted to occupy, in that they had that they dominated Central and Eastern Europe, and also they in. If you look at the Asiatic part of Russia, they controlled what was called the hinterland. I can't think who the author of Geopolitics was, but the hinterland is the sort of the bulk of the Eurasian landmass. And if you control, it's believed by people who advocate geopolitics that the nation that controls the bulk of the Eurasian landmass, the hinterland, is the force that will eventually dominate the world. And so what we've got is a situation now where the USSR took the place of Germany, because the Germans, if we'd left them to their own devices, they would have just pressed further eastward, and in view of the fact that they wouldn't have to form a Western front against Britain and America, they could have put all of their forces on the Eastern front, and then they almost certainly would have then overwhelmed the Russian armies and the armies of the USSR, and they would have then pushed certainly as far as the Urals and perhaps beyond the Urals, and perhaps would have conquered the entirety of what is today the USSR, and they would have then occupied the position currently held by the USSR. But that wasn't the case. Britain and America declared war against the Germans, so the Germans lost the Second World War, but it then enabled the Russians to take the place and to be this world power that occupied a great chunk of the European landmass, but also the vast bulk of the hinterland in Central Asia. And so that this was the realization that Enoch Powell made, was that we were now faced with a situation where America, because of its economic power, and Russia or the USSR, because of its domination of the hinterland, they were now the two world powers, and that Britain was almost irreversibly weakened by the fact that we had fought on the winning side during the Second World War, but had, in order to do that we had bankrupted ourselves as a nation in standing alone against Germany for so long.
You can understand why Britain went into that war when it's explained like that, because the fear was that Germany was going to have all of that, and Germany was going to be this big empire. So if we go to war, then it will be the Soviets, and the Soviets aren't going to be nearly as technologically advanced and nowhere near the powerhouse that the Germans are. So I think that may have played into it. And at the end of it, we ended up with an American empire and a USSR, which was the size of an empire. I mean, a huge landmass that it was controlling, and then just the tiny little island of Britain, a terrible state of affairs.
And it's also interesting that the world power that's currently sort of coming to the fore is China. And as far as China is concerned, not only do they control the far eastern parts of China, but they also control the vast areas of Central Asia, or vast areas of Central Asia, where they are up against the Uyghurs, effectively. And so therefore the Chinese are dealing with the Uyghurs fairly sort of ruthlessly, because by cementing their control of part of the hinterland, they are asserting their claim to be a world power. And so what we can see as far as Asia is concerned is a certain amount of tension between what is today Russia and China, in terms of their them sharing the hinterland. And it will be interesting to see how that game plays out.
Yeah, they seem to work together with the various things that, like the Belt and Road Initiative and the Shanghai Cooperation thing, or whatever it's called. Russia and China do seem to get on quite well, because both of them were originally communist. And of course, Enoch Powers was really interested in all of this geopolitics, as we'll see as we get further on into his life. But back in 1957, which is where we are here, when Harold Macmillan replaced Anthony Eden as Prime Minister, Powell was offered the office of Financial Secretary to the Treasury. This office was for the Chancellor of the Exchequer's deputy, and it was the most important position there was outside the Cabinet. But in January 1958, he resigned, along with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Peter Thornycroft, and his Treasury colleague, Nigel Birch. And this was in protest at government plans for increased expenditure, because he was a staunch advocate of disinflation, or in modern terms, a monetarist and a believer in market forces. The byproduct of this expenditure was the printing of extra money to pay for everything, which Powell believed to be the cause of inflation, and in effect a form of taxation, as the holders of money would find that their money was now worth a lot less. He was correct, and inflation rose to 2.5%, a high figure for the era, especially in peacetime. During the late 1950s, Powell promoted control of the money supply to prevent inflation, and during the 60s was an advocate of free market policies, which at the time were seen as extreme, unworkable, and unpopular. In his 1958 resignation over public spending and what he saw as an inflationary economic policy, he anticipated almost exactly the same views that during the 1980s came to be described as monetarism. And of course, he's quite correct here. If you print lots of money, you are going to cause inflation, and you do need to have control over the money supply. The banks should not have this control over the money supply. He was quite ahead of his time, I think, thinking this. Max, you know a fair bit about the economy and the finances and the rest of it. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, I think Enoch Powell was absolutely correct. There are two ways in which a government can increase the money supply in a country. One way is that they can actually print more pound notes, which increases the money supply, but doesn't increase the indebtedness of society and the government. But by increasing the money supply, you are therefore increasing the demand for products. And so therefore, the price of products goes up because of one of the fundamental principles of economics, that if there is a greater demand for something, then the price of it will go up. And so that in itself of printing money into the very principle of printing money and spending that into the economy will create inflation. The other way of increasing the money supply, as far as the country is concerned, is through using the fractional reserve banking principle, where money is borrowed into the economy. And this is a concept which is probably too complicated to explain over the radio. But effectively, what happens is that governments create more money by issuing loan certificates that are called government bonds. And through issuing these, the government acquires greater spending power. But at the same time, it also acquires government debt. And so this is the principle that exists at the moment, which causes not only inflation, but also increased government debt. And so Powell was correct, really, in identifying uncontrolled government spending as a cause of inflation. But the other thing that he should have focused on as well is the fact that through fractional reserve banking, not only was there inflation caused, but there was increased government debt caused as well. And the traditional weakness in Powell's argument and the monetarism that has been pursued by people like him since the 1950s and onwards is the fact that they have not identified fractional reserve banking as being the cause of not only of inflation but also of increased government debt as well, and the increase in government debt is just as dangerous for an economy as the inflation that's caused by printing more money. There really needs to be a system adopted whereby the money supply in a country is either relaxed, or control over the money supply is either relaxed or tightened in response to the amount of inflation that exists within society. And if a mechanism was set up, and there's no reason why a mechanism couldn't be set up And the mechanism that would need to be set up would be to use an analogy very similar to the kind of mechanism that exists in an engine that's got a fuel injection system, where the fuel injection system has sensors in place to detect when the fuel supply to an engine is becoming either too rich or too weak, and so therefore it then restricts or increases the amount of fuel getting through to the engine. And so a system of reporting just needs to be established within a country whereby inflationary factors are reported back to a central body that can then either restrict or increase the supply of money into the economy. And if a system such as that existed, then inflation could be, as a menace to society, could be completely eradicated. And in that respect, Powell was right. But where the monetarists went wrong is that they applied a simple principle of whenever the money supply was getting out of control, then they advocated increasing interest rates. By increasing interest rates, what that does is that means that those people that hold the debt where money is borrowed into existence, they receive far more interest than they otherwise would have done.
And what you end up with that is the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. So it was good of him to point this out and point out the solution, but his solution was no good either. I think if they did ever come up with a mechanism like the one that you described, Max, they'd hide it. They don't want a mechanism like that. They want there to be this inflation and increased interest rates. I mean, they've got, look at the interest rates at the moment. It's at naught, isn't it? And they're deliberately crashing the economy. They don't want the economy to function properly. It's that's not a part of the system that we have today. But yeah, he was really interested in the economy, and he stayed interested in that for the rest of his life. But on the 27th of July 1959, Powell delivered a speech about what happened at the Hola camp of Kenya, where 11 of the most hardcore Mau Mau terrorists were killed after refusing to join the rehabilitation process and work in the camp. Powell noted that some MPs had described the 11 as subhuman, and he responded by saying, "In general, I would say that it is a fearful doctrine which must recoil upon the heads of those who pronounce it, to stand in judgment on a fellow human being and to say, because he was such and such, therefore the consequences which would otherwise flow from his death shall not flow." Powell also disagreed with the notion that because it was in Africa, different methods were acceptable, saying, "Nor can we ourselves pick and choose where and in what parts of the world we shall use this or that kind of standard. We cannot say we will have African standards in Africa, Asian standards in Asia, and perhaps British standards here at home. We have not that choice to make. We must be consistent with ourselves everywhere. All government, all influence of man upon man rests upon opinion. What we can do in Africa, where we still govern and where we no longer govern, depends upon the opinion which is entertained of the way in which this country acts and the way in which Englishmen act. We cannot, we dare not, in Africa of all places, fall below our own highest standards in the acceptance of responsibility." Dennis Healy, a Member of Parliament from 52 to 92, later said that this speech was the greatest parliamentary speech I ever heard. It had all the moral passion and rhetorical force of Demosthenes. And the Daily Telegraph report of the speech said that, "As Mr. Powell sat down, he put his hand across his eyes. His emotion was justified, for he had made a great and sincere speech." Again, I think this really sums up the mentality in the British Empire. Even in the worst places, the most uncivilized places, we have to show the highest of standards. And that is the most important place for us to show that we still have these high standards and set a good example. So he was doing a really good thing here, I think. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Oh, just that is a first-class example, really, of what you were saying earlier on, of the way in which the British people who went out into the British Empire to be administrators of the British Empire, the fact that they had these very high ethical standards and that they tried to apply the benefits of those high ethical standards to the people that were under their control.
Yeah, there was no, we treat them differently to how we treat ourselves. I mean, it's gone a little bit too far now. We do too much for everybody else and not enough for ourselves. But back then, I think it was just about right. Well, Powell returned to the government in July 1960 when he was appointed health minister, although he did not become a member of the cabinet until 1962. During the thalidomide scandal, he could have shown more sympathy for the victims, refusing to meet with them and resisting calls for a public inquiry. However, he did do well in beginning the debate on psychiatric institutions and resisting the dumping of the inmates into the community. He claimed the criminally insane should never have been released and that the problem was one of funding. He said the new way of caring for the mentally ill would cost more, not less, than the old way, because community care was decentralized and intimate and being described at the time as more human. But his successors had not provided the money for local authorities to spend on mental health care, and therefore institutional care had been neglected, while at the same time there had been no funds forthcoming for community care either. So this care in the community and putting the criminally insane in the community, that didn't work. It also caused lots of people to be hurt. I'm a bit disturbed to hear that he didn't have much sympathy for the thalidomide victims. Do you know anything about that, Max? What went on in that time in the 60s with thalidomide?
No, I've got no knowledge of that. But it's clear that during the early 60s, Enoch Powell had already realised that the damage that would be done to our society by care in the community, and that by closing down the institutions that previously looked after people who were in need of psychiatric care, that those people would be released upon society and would do untold damage. And it's just very saddening, really, that here we are 60 years later, and still the present day government has not learned what Enoch Powell had realised back then, and that still we still release people who are irredeemable psychiatric cases into the community, and of course they go on to harm and in some cases kill again, and it's just very, very sad that Enoch Powell wasn't listened to then and that nobody's listened to him since.
They put the individual's needs above everything else, don't they? And they look at them as, oh, well, they are criminally insane, but they're individuals. You know, we have to put their rights above the rights of everybody else. It's an absolutely insane ideology. Now we get on to the immigration issue. During the 1964 general election, Powell said in his election address, "It was essential for the sake not only of our own people, but of the immigrants themselves, to introduce control over the numbers allowed in. I am convinced that strict control must continue if we are to avoid the evils of a colour question in this country, for ourselves and for our children." Norman Fowler, who was then a reporter for The Times, interviewed Powell during this election and asked him what the biggest issue was. "I expected to be told something about the cost of living, but not a bit of it. Immigration," replied Powell. "I duly phoned in my piece, but it was never used. After all, who in 1964 had ever heard of a former Conservative cabinet minister thinking that immigration was an important political issue?" After losing the election, he was made the Shadow Defence Secretary, and in a controversial speech on the 26th of May 1967, Powell criticised the UK's post-war world role, saying, "In our imagination, the vanishing last vestiges of Britain's once vast Indian Empire have transformed themselves into a peacekeeping role on which the sun never sets. Under God's good providence and in partnership with the United States, we keep the peace of the world and rush hither and thither, containing communism, putting out brush fires, and coping with subversion. It is difficult to describe, without using terms derived from psychiatry, a notion having so few points of contact with reality." And in 1967, Powell spoke of his opposition to the immigration of Kenyan Asians to the United Kingdom after the African country's leader Jomo Kenyatta's pro-Negro policies led to the flight of Asians from that country. So we're starting to see here that he's starting to wake up to the immigration issue. He's realizing that we're going to have the same problems over here in Britain that they had in America at the time, and why would we want to do this to ourselves? And he's also questioning what's happening with Britain now that we've lost the British Empire. Why are we still being expected to go around the world peacekeeping? and solving all the problems. They're not our problems anymore. These countries have got independence. We should not be getting involved over there. And he even points out that this is, you know, a completely insane notion, having so few points of contact with reality. It's also good to see that he was opposed to these Asians coming over from Africa, that Yasmin Alibi Brown, she's one of these Asians that we gave refuge to, who absolutely hates white people and has devoted her life to basically criticizing and attacking the very people that gave her refuge from this Kenyatta, who is apparently quite a nasty character, from what I hear. I believe somebody in the National Front might have emptied a bucket of blood over him when he came over here on one visit, or maybe another one.
I think that might have been Martin Webster that did that.
Yeah, was it Kenyatta who did that too?
I'm not sure he emptied a bucket of blood. I think he lunged forward out of a crowd of people and punched Kenyatta on the jaw and knocked him to the ground, effectively. I think that's what it was.
Well, we can't really condone that sort of behaviour, but I guess it was... I guess it was more acceptable back then. Max, you got any views on this and Powell waking up to immigration?
Well, I think that I can't really say much more about Powell waking up to immigration at this point, other than to just, I've got a fairly vivid memory of reading A.K. Chesterton's The New Unhappy Lords, which is a great read for anybody that manages to find that book. But A.K. Chesterton was a journalist during the 60s and 70s, and I'm not quite sure where he died, but he was a one-time leader of the National Front as well. But A.K. Chesterton wrote an article about the election in which Jomo Kenyatta was elected to be the leader of Kenya, and the point that in order that people would know who to vote for, the word Kenyatta means burning spear. And so this chap called Jomo decided to call himself Jomo Kenyatta because he adopted a burning spear as the symbol of his political movement. The other person who was fighting the election used the symbol of an elephant. And A.K. Chesterton recalls in The New Unhappy, Lords overhearing a group of Kenyans arguing about the pros and cons, the advantages and disadvantages of having a burning spear as opposed to an elephant in order to decide who they were going to vote for. Also sort of notes that because the Jomo Kenyatta had promised the people of Kenya that they would all have freedom after the election, that large numbers of them, when they turned out to vote, carried a bucket with them so they could take home their freedom, not actually realizing what freedom was and thinking it was something nice that they could collect in a bucket.
I guess a burning spear is better than a burning tire, the burning tire party, which we will get later on with Mandela. Well, now we get to the Rivers of Blood speech. The Birmingham-based television company ATV saw an advance copy of the speech on the Saturday morning, and its news editor ordered a television crew to go to the venue, where they did actually film sections of the speech, but there is no known copy of the entire speech that has become so famous. It's a great shame, that. Earlier in the week, Powell had said to his friend Clem Jones, a journalist and then editor at the Wolverhampton Express and Star, "I'm going to make a speech at the weekend, and it's going to go up fizz like a rocket. But whereas all rockets fall to the earth, this one is going to stay up." Powell was renowned for his oratorical skills and his maverick nature, and on the 20th of April 1968, he gave his speech in Birmingham, where he warned the audience of what he foresaw would be the consequences of continued unchecked mass migration from the Commonwealth into the UK. Above all, it is his allusion to the Roman poet Virgil towards the end of the speech which has most been remembered, giving the speech its colloquial name, the Rivers of Blood speech. He said, "As I look ahead, I am filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the River Tiber foaming with much blood. That tragic and intractable phenomenon which we watch with horror on the other side of the Atlantic, but which there is interwoven with the history and existence of the states itself, is coming upon us here by our own volition and our own neglect. Indeed, it has all but come. In numerical terms, it will be of American proportions long before the end of the 20th century. Only resolute and urgent action will avert it, even now. Whether there will be the public will to demand and obtain that action, I do not know. All I know is that to see and not to speak would be the greatest betrayal. The public loved it and thought, finally a politician is taking notice of what is happening. But the Times declared it an evil speech, stating this is the first time that a serious British politician has appealed to racial hatred in this direct way in our post-war history. And the public really did love it. I mean, it went down really, really well. But the thing about this is it was just so truthful. I mean, that is exactly what was going on. Everybody could see what was happening in America with the civil rights upsets and the riots and the trouble that they were having. And we didn't have the history that America had. We hadn't brought slaves to England to do the work. We didn't have any black people here to speak of until the end of the war. What were we doing importing these people into our country when we could see all the troubles that it had caused in America? An absolutely insane idea. And Enoch Powell was voicing this, and he united the public. You had the upper class people that supported him. You had the working class people that supported him. You had all the football supporters that supported him. I mean, this made him massively popular. And it was, I believe it was last year, that we actually had more murders in London than we had in New York, which was another prediction that he made in this speech, that there would be as many murders here as there were in America. And there's been lots of TV programs where they attack this speech and they attack him, but they never actually attack him for the truth of it. They just call him names. They just say it's racist. He said the black man will have the whip hand over the white. Oh, how racist that is. Well, we have black people that are in parliament, and that is the people that are in charge are in parliament. And that's what he was referring to, the whip hand, the master, the guy that's in charge. And we do. We have black MPs. We have black chief of anti-terrorism police. We have non-whites in all parts of society, and that was what he was predicting. So for people to claim that this speech didn't come true, they can't do that. So all they can do is call him names and call him racist, which he denied that he was a racist. We've got some quotes that we'll probably get into next week on that. But what are your thoughts on this speech, Max? Do you remember it when he actually gave it and the noise it made?
Yes, I do remember that period very distinctly. I think it's quite clear that at that point in time, something like 85% of the British public supported what he said. And this was the reason why the Tory party was so frightened and why he was threatened by the Conservative government at the time. And Enoch Powell was, I mean, if you can imagine the kind of popularity with which Nigel Farage has been held from time to time. Well, you know, Enoch Powell was Nigel Farage times 10. Edward Heath was greatly frightened by the fact that Enoch Powell had suddenly become this figure who was the man of the hour, so to speak. And so everything was done to shut Powell up. Powell at this particular point in time could, had he left the Conservative Party, had he resigned and formed his own political party, he could have swept the nation. There would have been a landslide victory for him at the next general election. And in my view, it is one of the greatest lapses of judgment in British history that Enoch Powell decided not to form his own political party at that point. Had he done so, the history of Britain since the late 60s would have been entirely different in this country. But that decision by him not to do that was cataclysmic, in my view, in terms of the impact on the future welfare and well-being of the British people. I can remember at the time the leaders of the National Front offering to step down and to allow Powell to become the chairman of the National Front. And you know, that was an offer that was actually made to him at the time, and yet he turned that down. And so, you know, that's a great disappointment that that he didn't seize the initiative at that key point in his career.
I think one of the incredible things about it is he had so much support, and yet he was universally slammed by the press. I mean, it points out that the Times attacked him here, but every single newspaper attacked him. Everybody on television attacked him, and yet the entire British public supported him so much. That, I mean, I still hear people in their 70s, in their 80s, that aren't nationalists, that talk about what a great politician Enoch Powell was. The first job that I had when I was 16, I can remember my boss telling me what a great man Enoch Powell was and how the country would have been completely different if he had been prime minister. I'd never heard of him, never heard of the guy. And yet, you know, you just come across people talking about him throughout your life and you become interested in him, which is why I'm really pleased we're doing this series and going so into depth in what went on in the man's life, because he really was one of our very greatest of Britons. And I guess we better leave it there for this week, Max, and we'll continue talking about this speech and the rest of his life next time. Is there anything else that you want to add before we finish?
No, I think this is a good point for us to pause.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.